This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. It seems just about every week more news emerges of the ever closer relationship between Russia and China. These two countries were fierce enemies in the not too distant past, but they've turned things around dramatically and world events are driving them into each other's arms more all the time. This is an extraordinary development, not only because it's changing the future of geopolitics, it's also one of the most stunning fulfillments of Bible prophecy that we see in the world today. We're going to hear a report about this from Jeremiah Jacques. Does fat in your food make you fat? For decades, we've been hearing that fats are bad. Our grocery stores are full of low-fat and no-fat products. But now experts are saying this conventional wisdom is wrong. Fats are actually good for you. We'll get to the bottom of this question in a conversation with certified holistic nutritionist Jorg Mardian. He'll help us to know which fats are bad, which are good, and how much is the right amount. And I'll conclude today's show by talking about the importance of understanding your own thought processes and how the Bible can help. But we're going to start today by talking about the Munich Security Conference, which just concluded in Germany this past week. It's a very important annual conference, one that had a lot of interesting takeaways this year. To talk about this, we have via Skype from our office in Britain, trumpet writer Richard Palmer. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
Tell us what the Munich Security Conference is and why it's so important.
So it's an annual meeting mostly focused on the transatlantic relationship. It's held in Munich, Germany. So it focuses on the relationship between Europe and America, and most importantly, Germany and America. It's an opportunity for major leaders from all around the world to get together, to talk to each other, both on stage in front of large groups and to make official policy announcements, and then also in much smaller settings, in back rooms, literal back rooms, to do backroom dealing and one-on-one type conversations. So usually you'll have high-profile people from all across the world there, but especially from Germany and from the United States. So this year you had Vice President Mike Pence was kind of headlining the U.S. Administration there. You also had people like John Kerry and Joe Biden coming forward and putting their alternative view forwards and trying to basically argue against Mr. Trump and some of the things he's doing. You had the German Chancellor Angela Merkel, the German Foreign Minister, the German Defense Minister all gave speeches. You had Sergei Lavrov, I believe he's a regular, and he was there this year from Russia. You had the Iranian foreign minister, Zarif was there, senior members from China. There were senior members from Saudi Arabia. I think they were scheduled to be there. They didn't make it. Senior members from Israel. So, you know, very major decision makers, highly influential people from all around the world, but then with that special focus on Europe and the United States.
So Stephen Fleury spoke about this on his Trumpet Daily Radio show on Monday, and he focused particular attention on the tensions that have arisen between Germany and the United States. In some ways, this obviously isn't a new story, but it definitely emerged at this conference in some fairly visible ways. Bring us up to speed on that.
Yeah, this was by far the biggest takeaway that the press gain took from this. Now, just to read some headlines, the New York Times: rift between Trump and Europe is now open and angry. The Washington Post: an off-key Pence sings from the Trump hymnal to a stony European reception. Politico: a transatlantic atomic blast from the past, tensions between Europe and America have gone nuclear. These were the type of headlines you were getting, really focusing on this split between Europe and the United States. It was two very different messages brought from Germany and from the European speakers. And Mr. Flory made the point on the show yesterday that often the Munich Security Conference, because it's focused on transatlantic relations, normally, no matter how bad relations may be in real life, it's the chance. It's the time for both sides to get together for a nice photo op and hugs and handshakes. And okay, you know, yeah, we may have some arguments, but all married couples bicker, and at the end of the day, our relationship is fundamentally solid. That's normally the message that you get that they put out at that conference. This wasn't that way. It was much more of a just, we're here, we're bringing different messages, and nobody's even really talking much about unity. Mm-hmm. I mean, right at the heart of this divide and at this conference was a speech by German Chancellor Angela Merkel and then US President, Vice President Mike Pence. And, well, first of all, the reception that they got in this audience of largely European, because it's in Munich, security experts. Angela Merkel was there. She gave her speech. At the end, there was an applause that went on for, I timed it, it's almost exactly a minute of them clapping, lots of people standing. At the end, you know, she's kind of emotional and almost holding back tears. And this is from Angela Merkel, who's not normally very emotional. You know, this amazing reaction to her speech. Meanwhile, you had
just for a second, what do you suppose is behind that? I realize that there are a lot of people looking at this as, you know, maybe something like she's in her final days, but she hasn't exactly been a paragon of popularity lately. They're trying to send a message, it seems. Was it aimed at the United States to some degree, or was there something else going on there?
No, I think it's aimed at the United States. I also think, you know, when you say she hasn't been a paragon of popularity, that's very much amidst the common people. Hmm. This was the European elite that was there, the experts, the bureaucrats.
They're recognizing she's been somewhat beleaguered in the public opinion, but as far as they're concerned, she's the same hero that she's been.
Oh, they love her. I mean, that was her conclusion of her speech. You know, the theme of the conference was, it was something like, who's going to pick up the pieces? Mm-hmm. The world is falling apart. Who's going to save it? And her answer was, all of us. By working together, by negotiating, by diplomacy, we are the solution. We are the hope we've been looking for. Mm-hmm. And to diplomats and security experts and people that specialize in going and talking to other countries, you know, that's music to your ears, that you are the solution to the problems, and it's a multilateral approach. You know, they love that.
Yeah. So by contrast, Mike Pence comes up and didn't quite receive the same celebration.
Exactly. He got up there and he said, I bring you greetings from President Donald Trump. And he paused for applause. And he got several seconds of awkward silence. You could kind of hear him breathing into the microphone. He didn't quite say, and moving on. But it was that kind of a feeling. They definitely did not like the message that he was bringing there.
What are they disagreeing over exactly here?
Well, I think this is the interesting thing, because if you look at all of the press coverage, especially the American press coverage, this is Donald Trump's fault.
Right.
That this is him dividing Europe from America, and he is single-handedly destroying the global order that has kept peace in the world since World War II. You look at the substance of what these disagreements are about and you get a completely different picture. Instead, you look at the substance and it's Europe abandoning America, Europe going their own way, Europe wanting something radically different for the world. So one of the big ones was this and I say Europe, I should be saying Germany, because there are some in Europe that are on America's side. George Friedman just made this point in an article he put out yesterday. But one of the big things that Mike Pence brought up with this disagreement was this pipeline that Germany's building with Russia, this Nord Stream pipeline.
Yes, which Gerald Flory's talked a lot about.
Right. And he said, we cannot ensure the defense of the West if our allies grow dependent on the East. And just like Mr. Flory's talked about, this is Germany turning away from NATO, Germany turning away from its relationship with the United States and trying to build a relationship with Russia, building an alliance really with Russia. I mean, you look at the way Russia uses their natural gas and everything like that. This isn't just a business deal. And then one of the other big disagreements, Iran, where Mike Pence issued this impassioned plea for other countries to come on board and to back the United States in confronting Iran. Meanwhile, you've got Europe choosing Iran over America, or at least Germany and France, choosing Iran over America, saying, no, you know what, we're going to keep supporting Iran. We're going to keep helping this terrorist sponsoring nation rather than helping the United States. So, yes, there's this divide, but it's really Europe that's going off and doing their own thing in some quite dramatic areas.
So I guess in keeping with this, we've had the recent breaking of the INF nuclear treaty between Russia and America. This is obviously something that causes a lot of anxiety in Europe. The fact that Russia would not be bound by the limitations imposed by that treaty. But you know, the United States, I think, makes a very strong case that they had no choice really but to do that based on European or based on Russian action. The story is very different in Europe. They're pointing all the fingers at the United States.
That's right. This was one of the other big things that came up in the disagreement. This is what Politico talked about in their Atomic Blast from the Past article. They wrote that just when it looked like the US and EU had run out of things to fight about, a fresh rift has emerged about how to forestall a new arms race with Russia. And this is something German Chancellor Angela Merkel brought up. She said in her speech, to be perfectly honest, for us Europeans, the really bad news of this year is the cancellation of the INF treaty. So it was more confirmation that Europe is really concerned about this. And what I think brought this to a head at the conference is, again, you look fundamentally, Germany wants a if not an alliance, at least a deal, a compromise, a relationship with Russia. And when they kind of brought up the INF treaty with NATO and with the Americans in the run-up to this conference and at this conference, it became very clear that America doesn't really care too much either way whether there's another INF treaty. You know, they were talking about where do we go from here. There wasn't that issue isn't something of much importance to the Trump administration. At least that's the impression European leaders are putting forward. But Germany wants a deal. Germany wants a relationship. And so now you're seeing this fundamental divide on how to deal with the INF, and Europe was getting cross with the United States, you know, saying, well, we didn't want this deal to be completely destroyed. We still want to deal with Russia. And I think you could well see then Germany, this being an angle of Germany turning to Russia and trying to come up with their own type of deal to cover this impasse, because that's the type of world that they want, one where they've got an accommodation with Russia.
This really seems very consistent with exactly what Gerald Fleury was talking about and what Mike Pence brought up when he was criticizing Germany for making this deal with Russia. Essentially, you have these two powers coming together and closing ranks against the United States.
Yes, and other people brought out just how much Russia and China seem to be kind of courting Germany, trying to drive a wedge between the United States and the EU. I don't think they needed to try that hard with Germany, but both Russia and China at this conference went out of their way to criticize the United States and to praise Europe and to kind of paint the United States as an overbearing figure that's patronizing Europe, that's trying to boss them around, and really say, you know, come to us. We'll treat you much better. And what Mr. Fleury brought up in that article from September 2018, Germany and Russia's secret war against America, is really this has already happened. If Germany's going off, just like Mike Pence said, if Germany's going off and forming this pipeline deal, that does fundamentally undermine NATO. And that's not an accident. That's not something that Germany, an unintended consequence that Germany didn't think about. They know exactly what they're doing in forming this relationship with Russia. Like I said, George Friedman had a column yesterday where he just talked about this fundamental divide now and kind of long-term realignment between Germany and the United States that you saw on display at that conference. So you're seeing something just vividly displayed that Mr. Fleury wrote about 6 months ago. And what I really thought of watching that conference, watching even the reception that Mike Pence got versus the reception that Angela Merkel got, was a point that Mr. Fleury made in there, quoting Jeremiah 1 and verse 13, that talks about Germany being a seething pot. And in that article, he wrote, this symbolic language is describing modern Germany. Beneath the surface, that nation is full of simmering dissatisfaction with the current world order. Germans are angry at the U.S. and especially furious with President Trump. The imperialistic ambitions that prompted Germany to start both world wars is alive and well. It is seething. And to me, that was what was on display in Munich, was the seething pot of dissatisfaction in the U.S., in the EU, and especially in Germany, against the United States. And the whole tenor and outcome of that conference just really underlines that analysis.
Well, we do appreciate that. There's quite a lot of takeaways that we can take from that conference, and so many strands of prophecy that we're seeing on display and unfolding there. We've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about the Munich Security Conference. He wrote about this in his trumpet brief yesterday. This is our daily email service, and you can subscribe to the trumpet brief at thetrumpet.com. But go check out his article on this subject there at the website. Thank you very much for your time, Richard.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The relationship between Russia and China is getting closer and stronger all the time. This is not only an extraordinary development that is changing the future of geopolitics, it's also one of the most stunning fulfillments of Bible prophecy in the world today, as we will now hear in this report from Jeremiah Jacques.
China and Russia are more aligned than at any point since the mid-1950s. That was the conclusion of a January report by the United States Director of National Intelligence. Bloomberg took an even bolder view in a November analysis, saying Russia and China are, quote, now as close as at any time in their 400 years of shared history. These kinds of statements are becoming fairly commonplace. Most analysts recognize the deepening relationship between Russia and China, but few realize that this new reality has major implications for every person alive. The shared history of Russia and China stretches back 400 years, as the Bloomberg report said there, and for much of it, they were at odds with each other. During the Cold War of the last century, the tensions became especially severe, and the Soviet Union and China went to war over their shared border. For decades, the hostilities between them ran deep, but in 1991, the Soviet Union collapsed. And for the next decade, Russia was a defeated, depleted nation outside the mainstream of world affairs. During this time, much of the Western world ignored Russia or even looked down on it to a degree, but not China. The Chinese recognized that they had much to learn from the Russians about armaments and warfare. The Chinese understood that in order to be able to stand up to Western powers in the future, they would need a partner. So during those years of Russian weakness and instability, China treated Russia with scrupulous respect. Throughout the 1990s, China repeatedly reached out to Russia and consistently treated it as if it were still a superpower. The Chinese worked with the Russians across a wide range of issues, and this was like a balm on Russia's badly wounded ego. Around the year 2000, Vladimir Putin became Russia's president, and China's esteem and respect for Russia increased even more. Cooperation between the two also rapidly increased. If we look at the world today, in international politics, it's clear that Russia-China cooperation is accomplishing nothing short of reshaping the world. They routinely join forces to oppose Western interests in the Middle East, the Korean Peninsula, Venezuela, and elsewhere. Russia and China also support each other's growing territorial appetites in the South China Sea and the former Soviet nations. With their cooperation in these kinds of pursuits, the two are reshaping international politics. And then economic developments tell the same story. In 2010, China became Russia's largest trading partner. 5 years later, Russia became China's top supplier of crude oil. In 2018, Russia and China exceeded $100 billion in mutual trade for the first time. A substantial part of this consisted of China buying advanced Russian weaponry, such as fighter jets and the S-400 anti-aircraft system. And that leads into the most meaningful manifestation of the Russia-China axis, which is military cooperation. In 2003, the two started holding joint military drills. That first drill, and the others in those early years, were low-level exercises, often involving just a handful of soldiers from Russia and a handful from China. But over the years, these military exercises evolved into massive and complex maneuvers, often with thousands of military personnel from each country taking part. Russia and China were growing astoundingly close, yet they still kept their most important military secrets from each other. But then came a certain joint air missile exercise in 2017. Stephen Blank is a senior fellow with the American Foreign Policy Council, and he's called quite a lot of attention to this particular 2017 drill, saying, quote, "It suggests an alliance between Russia and China." He said that's because the exercise required both nations to, quote, "put their cards on the table and display their C4ISR," end quote. This term refers to the four C's of command, control, communications, and computer, and the ISR stands for intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. So the systems and techniques related to C4ISR are among the most sensitive aspects of a nation's military. The fact that Russia and China shared this information with each other, beginning with those 2017 drills, indicates a new and very rare level of trust. Vasily Kashin is a senior research fellow at the Higher School of Economics in Moscow. I spoke with him on February 11th, and he said this 2017 exercise was indeed a big step forward for Russia and China, but he said the next year's Vostok 2018 exercise was even more important. Vostok 2018 saw more than 300,000 soldiers, 36,000 military vehicles, 1,000 aircraft, and 80 naval vessels come together. It's believed to have been the largest military exercises ever held for any nations. China's People's Liberation Army contributed 3,200 troops, 900 combat vehicles, and 30 aircraft, which made it China's largest ever dispatch of forces abroad for military exercises. Altogether, Russia and China have now held more than 30 sets of military drills as they iron out the details of how to join their forces for potential conflicts. Kashin wrote in a 2018 report for the Center of Naval Analysis that if at some point Russia and China decide to jointly intervene in a local conflict, their militaries would act as a very strong force multiplier for each other. He continued, writing, quote, "China's superior surface navy and its logistical and unmanned aerial vehicle capabilities would be coupled with Russia's battle-hardened ground and air forces, as well as its air defense, submarine, and long-range strike advantages." Some experts still believe Russia and China have too many differences to ever form a true military alliance. The skeptics say obstacles such as historical border disputes and their conflicting interests in Central Asia are just too meaningful for Russia and China to truly militarily unite. Even Vasily Kashin wrote in his report that although Russia and China are laying the groundwork to be able to join forces, currently there are no observable scenarios under which the two sides might undertake a joint action. But a look at Bible prophecy shows that exactly such a scenario will soon emerge. Bible prophecy says that just before the return of Jesus Christ, a war will erupt that will be so destructive it'll have the capacity to end all human life. Jesus Christ himself spoke about this, as recorded in Matthew 24, 21, and 22, and it's clear from this and related passages that this will be a nuclear World War III. Daniel 11 verse 40 shows that this civilization-threatening war will begin when a radical Islamic power, led by Iran, pushes against a unified European power. The passage says that after this Islamic power, called the King of the South, pushes at the European power, called the King of the North, the Europeans will unleash a fury of devastation on Iran and its Islamic partners. This clash will rattle the world. Russia and China, both of which have close ties with Iran, and both of which desire to exert greater influence in the Middle East, will perhaps be more jolted by this than any other nations. And this clash between Europe and Iran-led radical Islam will help create exactly the scenario that Vasily Kashin says is presently absent on the world scene. Russia and China will see how powerful Europe has become. They'll see how effectively it wields its power. And they'll see that in order to challenge this mighty united Europe, they must join forces. And Bible prophecy shows that this is what they'll do. Daniel 11, verse 41 through 44, show that the Europeans start conquering more and more of the Middle East, but then they're suddenly interrupted. Verse 44 says, "But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him," meaning the European power. A look at a map shows that to the east of the region where Europe's conquests will be occurring is China, and to the north is Russia. The Europeans will hear tidings from Russia and China, and they'll be troubled by them. They'll be disturbed to learn that Russia and China have expanded and merged their militaries in order to challenge Europe. Bible prophecy provides numerous details about this Russo-Chinese force, showing exactly why Europe will be so troubled by it. And the prophecies also show just how unbelievably devastating this end-time nuclear war will be. But the Bible's prophecies don't end with nuclear war eradicating mankind. In Matthew 24, just after Christ said the end-time war will be so devastating that it could end all human life, he adds a crucial detail. He said that it will be shortened. He himself will shorten it. Jesus Christ will return before the chaos obliterates all human life, and he'll put an end to that war. Revelation 19, 11 through 16 show that Christ will become King of Kings, ruling the entire earth. Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong was the editor-in-chief of The Trumpet's forerunner magazine, The Plain Truth, and he wrote extensively about this future kingdom. In the June 1964 issue of The Plain Truth, he wrote, quote, "The governments of Russia, China, Japan, and yes, also of the U.S., Britain, and France will be overthrown. There will be a different system of government. It will be God's government." And then Mr. Armstrong emphasized something very inspiring that should resonate and give encouragement to every one of us. He said that Christ will not rule this kingdom by himself, but instead will enlist those who have learned to love God's way of life to help him. Mr. Armstrong wrote, quote, "Christ will assign some who have learned and lived his way, the way of his government during this life, to rule with him." Mr. Armstrong went on to explain that as we see Russia and China rising and aligning, and as we see the world hurtling toward conflict, it should make us put our hope in this future righteous government. It should make us take action now so that we can help administer that government in the future. It is sobering to see Russia and China aligning today and working to end the U.S.-led international order that's brought relative peace to the world for so many decades. But there's also great hope in this trend. It means a new government, a perfect government that will bring prosperity to all those it governs, is coming soon. And as Mr. Armstrong wrote, in this new government, there are positions open.
All right, thank you for that, Jeremiah. That's a really terrific overview of this subject. This has to be one of the most astounding examples of how accurate the Bible's prophecies are. You mentioned Herbert Armstrong describing that future world, but he was also forecasting this Russia-China alliance for so long. He would be astounded to see how this story has developed in the, what is it, nearly two and a half decades or three decades since he died.
I think he would be flabbergasted to see it. I mean, he wouldn't be totally surprised because right. He always said this will happen, but to see it, you know, become a reality, I really think that it would have been amazing if he'd been able to live to see this that we're now seeing come to pass.
It is interesting. You were quoting those verses in Daniel that talk about this European empire, and then the fact that it's troubled by tidings out of the east. We were talking in the first segment with Richard about just this kind of fraught relationship between Europe and Asia, and the fact that in some ways their geopolitical interests have aligned to the degree that they're trying to take America out, but it's not a relationship that is going to have any long-standing wherewithal when you look at what this prophecy is saying. In some ways, we see this already. There's quite a lot of concern among Europeans about what's happening in Asia, but maybe you can put that in the larger prophetic context, what it is that concerns Europe so much about what they see happening in Asia.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, the first thing that comes to mind when you talk about Europe and Asia currently aligned, but only kind of precariously so, it just makes me think of World War II with Germany and Japan.
Right.
The two were, you know, they were allies, but they both had plans of turning on each other once they defeated their common enemies. So I think that's the sort of scenario that we can expect with Europe and Asia and end time prophecy.
Well, not to mention even just the relationships leading up to it, where there was a certain amount of collusion. There was even treaties between them, but it turned out that that only lasted as long as it was politically expedient for the leaders at the time.
That's right. Yeah, so those sorts of things are fragile and will quickly be broken. But Bible prophecy does talk a lot about exactly why, you know, these tidings out of the East and the North will trouble Europe. You know, Revelation 9:16 says that this Asian force will have 200 million soldiers. So that's orders of magnitude larger than any force the world has seen. Revelation 16:12 reveals what may be the most troubling tiding of all for those Europeans, and that's basically just that they will mobilize from Asia and start to head toward, you know, toward the West to be able to confront the Europeans. So that's a very interesting passage there. And then Ezekiel 38 is a key Bible prophecy there about this that even lists some of the specific nations that will take part. It shows that Russia will be at the head of all of them, using, of course, ancient names for modern Russia and China and Japan and India. But it's a really fascinating passage, and we really go into great depth with these in our booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy. So if anyone would like to understand you know, those ancient prophecies and how they're describing what we're now seeing today in detail, then I would highly recommend that free booklet.
Yeah, absolutely. Russia and China in Prophecy, you can find that on thetrumpet.com. That goes into a lot of detail. If you have any interest in this whatsoever, you will be astounded to see those prophecies spelled out and just how we're seeing this unfold in the world news today. We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about this growing alliance between Russia and China. He's written an article for the coming edition of the Trumpet magazine, the April 2019 edition. The article is called Axis of Authoritarians. That'll be posted next week to thetrumpet.com. Thank you, Jeremiah.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
For over 30 years, we've been hearing that fats are bad. Experts encouraged us to ditch traditional fats. They told people to use low-fat alternatives. Well, today, that trend is reversing. Fats are good for us again, but with some caveats. Now, if you're still on the fat is bad bandwagon, you might want to look at recent studies that show this advice isn't making us healthier. To talk about this, we have, via his office in British Columbia, certified holistic nutritionist Jorg Mardian. Hello, Jorg.
Hello, pleased to be here.
It's good to have you, as usual. So tell us how the low-fat craze started.
Well, it is a craze. It really is. You know, I'll just start at the beginning. 100 years ago, obesity and coronary heart disease was virtually unknown.
Mm-hmm.
It was in the low percentages. So, and here we are a century later, and the most common cause of death are coronary heart disease and cancer. So, and that accounts for about 75% of all death in this country. So now how it started, the fear of saturated fat started in the 50s, and there was a landmark study, and it was called the Seven Country Study. by Dr. Ansel Keys. And really what this study did is cherry-pick data from just a select few countries. I think it was about 7 out of 22 countries. So it was really flimsy data. And yet, for some reason, even though some scientists were against it, this took root. And so these recommendations to go low-fat took America by storm. It absolutely went crazy. And millions of people started shunning traditional fatty foods. So we're looking at eggs or meat or full dairy, you know, stuff like that, which is what a lot of people ate in those days. So there's a book that's called The Obesity Epidemic. What caused it? How can we stop it? And it was written by Barry Groves. And he said, I mean, he has 1,000 references, 1,000 documenting how replacing saturated fat in the American diet with carbohydrates and processed the polyunsaturated vegetables is killing us today. It's well documented. So it took root, grabbed people, and even today we have evidence to the contrary, but we can't shake this fat is bad mentality.
So you still see a lot of the products, low-fat alternatives on the stores, the grocery store shelves, and people trying to lose weight by eating products that are specifically manufactured to reduce the kind of fats that you're talking about.
Yeah, I just don't see it being something that they'll take off the shelves. It's just rooted deep in the minds of the American public. And I mean, in reality, fats are actually essential for your body to function. So,
yeah, well, let's talk about healthy fats. What types of fats are healthy?
Well, despite all the hearsay, saturated fats, the animal-sourced fats, are actually healthy. I mean, the studies show it. The other ones that are touted and pushed are the unsaturated fats. So you're monounsaturated and you're polyunsaturated. So you're going to, the monounsaturated are your avocados, your olive oil, almonds, pecans, and other nuts. And then your polyunsaturated are your flaxseed and walnuts, fatty fish. And of course, both. The both types will be included in the cooking oils as well. And that's what we're being pushed with today, the all these cooking oils as the number one source of polyunsaturated fat, which I think is a tragic mistake.
Okay, well, until you started talking about oil, what I noticed about everything that you mentioned is that these are actually foods. You're talking about being able to get these fats from foods that are recognizable. But the point that you made, you're talking about polyunsaturated fats being found in fish and other sources, but then we get into a problem if we're actually trying to derive cooking oils from them. Maybe you can explain that.
Well, I'm talking about wholesome foods and I'm talking about man-made foods.
Right.
There's a difference. Whenever man touches something, he corrupts it. Well, I'll say a large part of in the food chain. I mean, if that was not the case, and if anybody says, well, this guy's crazy for saying that, why do we have 80% of people getting diseased today?
Right. So, the more processed our food becomes, the bigger the problems that we have. So you're saying, so the processes that would create these cooking oils, this is where the problem is. And maybe you could just name some of the oils that you're talking about.
Right. So the processes that I'll just start with saying this, trans fats are not gone since 2018. I mean, we know they're just killing us. They were killing us. And so thankfully they're out of the American diet. I think some companies still have a couple years leeway as they're trying to get them out of all the formulations. But if you're looking at the bad fats, you're looking at canola is just a wickedly bad oil. Peanut oils that are processed, corn oil, soybean, sunflower oils. I mean, those are all something that you just don't want to have in your diet, because they're basically oils that have been corrupted right from the start through light, air, and they're really rancid oils by the time they get to us. They have to be deodorized by the time they get put into a bottle, you know? So what we really want is the oils that are unprocessed, that are expeller pressed slowly, because we want those key components in there, you know, like in unsaturated fats. Key components would be your EFAs, your omega threes and sixes. And these are special, special components of that oil. We don't want to destroy them, because there's studies that show you can lower mortality risk by 27%. You can lower heart disease risk by 35%. And overall, you can live 2 to 3 years longer by making sure that those are in the diet. The studies actually show that. So we don't want to destroy those through processing. And so just to
reiterate that specific ingredient you mentioned, you used some numbers and some letters that this is what we want. I missed exactly what that was.
So they're omega-3s and 6s.
Yeah.
Right? They're linoleic acid and alpha-linoleic acid. So they're omega-3s and 6s. And we want those in the polyunsaturated oils. But they're easily damaged.
I see.
Not only the process of refining them damages, but also when we cook with these oils. Mm-hmm. And this is what a lot of people don't understand. You know, when we cook with these oils, you have 100 dangerous oxidization products found roughly in these oils. So not only does the processing cause damage, but our cooking with them causes damage. Hmm. And so again, it's documented. Another thing that people don't know about these type of oils is I saw a study from Poland showing that there's 70 to 80 pesticides found in these oils.
Wow.
If you can believe it or not. So now what's happening with that? Well, we have pesticides, we have genetic modifications, you're getting organ damage, you're getting digestive problems, cancer. I mean, Udo Erasmus, he wrote a landmark book in the 80s, Fats That Heal and Fats That Kill, and he said up to 65 to 70% of our disease today is because of processed oils. I was stunned at that statistic.
Fats that heal, fats that kill. That's quite a statement. That there are some that actually have a reparative effect in the body, and others that destroy it.
That's the key. And people are just confused. What's a good fat? What's a bad fat? What's a polyunsaturated? What's a monounsaturated? Mm-hmm. What are the omega-3s and 6s? There's so much confusion that reigns with people. And I would tell people, just look what's natural in foods rather than processed foods. Now, if we're going to look at safe sources of oils, then you would look at expeller pressed oils, because they use low temperatures and they're extracted from organic seeds and nuts. Coconut oil is one of my favorites. You can cook with that stuff. It's safe. Extra virgin olive oils, make sure it's not corrupted with these cooking oils, because that's what's happening a lot today. MCT, flaxseed, avocado, basically any oil that's been slowly processed and that's also in a solid glass, dark glass bottle, and it has the label unrefined.
Okay.
That's a lot of instruction.
Yeah, well, that's pretty clear. Definitely some specific things that we can keep our eyes peeled when we're going through the grocery aisles and deciding what we're going to cook with. And as far as that, you were mentioning even the cooking itself can damage the oils. Any thoughts on use of, even if you get the right oil, are there things that you need to think about on the use of them?
Well, the thing is, a lot of people fry their foods. It's common. You want to use an oil that's very, very stable. You know, cooking oils are unstable. We know that. There's no question about it. I like using coconut oil I like using butter. I have zero problems with it. I just don't buy into the theory, the cholesterol theory, that this is going to harm me in moderate amounts. It's just not. It never has been proven. We have studies showing the opposite. So I don't cook in olive oil. It's just not, it's just something I drizzle over my vegetables or my salads because the flash point on cooking oil is much lower. So you want to use a really stable oil, like a coconut oil that can take that heat, but still don't heat too high. I mean, why be in a rush? Why does something have to be cooked in 5 minutes when it should take 15 minutes? You're just going to char the food and then kill the natural oils that are in there anyway. So even if you use a good oil, if you cook at too high a temperature, you'll actually damage the oils in the product, the food itself.
Yeah. So so much of the fat is bad craze revolved around trying to, say, reverse the trend toward obesity. The idea is that eating fat makes you fat. Is it true?
Absolutely not. Well, there's a caveat to that.
Okay.
I've changed my diet somewhat too. I'm going to a little bit higher fat in my diet, and I'm dropping my carbohydrates down to more of a 25% in my diet. And so as I'm studying this, I change my approach to eating over the years as well as I get older. Just, I thought I was, you know, I'm not getting younger, so I have to change. I have to be wiser in how I eat. And I find that if I take these unrefined oils, I'm not as hungry. I don't have cravings. So what happens is when you have a little bit of a higher fat content, the body actually uses that for energy if the carbohydrates aren't too high. So if the carbohydrates are high and the oil is high, you're going to gain weight. And then that fat is just going to sit. It's just not going to magically disappear. But again, I always counsel my clients. I said, look, overeating is just one of the things that we should look at. Why are you getting cravings? Because you're not getting the right types of food in there. Fat is actually, you should take at least 3 tablespoons of some kind of good fat. I love unrefined polyunsaturated oils, and then I take a fish oil, and I'll take 2 or 3 tablespoons a day, and surprisingly, my hunger was just crushed. So I'm eating less. Now I just have to eat good with what I do eat, and the carbohydrates, most of them today, are refined, so we find that cutting those down, and then the weight just goes boom, and it just comes off you naturally without a lot of effort, you know. And then if we look at saturated fats as well, there was an analysis done of 20 or 30 studies, and they showed that saturated fats themselves have zero correlation with heart disease. So today we know that. And again, I'm talking about moderation. I'm not talking about going out and eating 4 T-bones in a row, right? And then other studies actually show that the risk for heart disease and mortality is reduced as we eat some more saturated fats. So that shows how low we were in saturated fats, the needed ones for your brain function and your cellular function. Your body, your very cellular structure, the renewing of your body works with saturated fats.
Well, fascinating stuff. You've given us a lot of actionable information here. Anything, if you had to summarize it in a few sentences, what's the overall message?
The overall message is one of moderation. I mean, you want to stay healthy. So what you should do is eat natural foods containing saturated fats in proper amounts. Don't overeat them. You know, they can be part of a healthy diet. And then concentrate on quality sources of fruits, vegetables, traditional dairy products, poultry, fish, and meats, and nuts and seeds. It's a lot, you know, but it's easily sourced if you want on the internet, if you look. But just keep it natural, unprocessed, and you do very well.
Well, very good. We've been talking with certified holistic nutritionist York Mardian about fats. He's working on an article on the subject. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much, York.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
How well do you know yourself? Not just your desires or interests. How well do you understand how and why you think your particular thoughts? What makes you do what you do? Be honest. Are there ever times when you have thoughts you don't like or don't understand, or even worse, emotions you can't explain? Do you ever feel disappointed because you keep doing things you've promised yourself you'd overcome? In your relationships, do you find yourself dealing with the same problems, making the same mistakes time and time again? Surely we can all answer yes to at least some of these questions. Why? Because they're common to the human experience. Even the Apostle Paul, one of the most prolific biblical writers, was well acquainted with these frustrations. In Romans 7 and verse 15, he wrote, "I do not understand my own actions, for I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate." Why is this the case? Sometimes it seems as if our own minds are a big puzzle. Think about how our minds are so easily drawn to things that are forbidden to us. Advertisers take advantage of this human tendency all the time. Books and movies and art exhibits that arouse scandal tend to attract bigger audiences. Think about that. Why does reverse psychology work on us? Why can it be so effective, where we do something only because it's the opposite of what is expected? Why do we naturally resist when we're told what to do, or when we know that something is right? Why is it so hard to admit when we're wrong? Can you explain these conundrums? Again, how well do you really know yourself? How well do you know the inner workings of your mind? Most people just live with the problem. They don't think much about it. They think, well, life is complicated enough without trying to unriddle yourself. Other people who are desperate for a solution, they think that they'll believe every promise of every self-help book, every television psychiatrist or psychic, or they'll build their lives around humanly devised plans and programs. The Bible states the problem in terminology that is shockingly explicit, so much so that most people would reject it, even though they are living proof of its truth. Jeremiah 17 and verse 9 says, "The heart, that is the seat of intellect, the human mind, is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it?" That's what the Bible says. Do you disagree? Does that seem too harsh? It takes penetrating personal honesty to recognize the rightness in Jeremiah's statement. 1 Kings 8 and verse 38 talks about the importance of every person knowing the plague of his own heart. Does that ring true in your life? Do you recognize that plague in your mind? If you don't admit it, you can never change it. The fact is, most of the problems in this world are caused by people who are woefully ignorant about themselves. They may be doing the best they know how, they may sincerely desire to do better, but they're stuck. As Proverbs 16 verse 25 says, "There is a way that seems right to a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death." Why is the human mind so malignant? The Creator God designed it. Did He fashion it in all those deceptive intricacies? Did He make it desperately wicked? Well, most people have never even contemplated that issue. Perhaps more important, what can be done about it? Recognizing the problem is one thing, overcoming it is another altogether. Are we destined to remain plagued by a self-deceitful and wicked heart? These are important questions, pressing questions that you need the answers to. I'd like to offer you free copies of two booklets. The first is called Human Nature, What Is It? This will explain why the human mind is the way it is. And the second is called Repentance Toward God. This will show the first steps necessary to begin to change. It'll give the universally overlooked key to self-mastery and to lasting success. The Bible really does explain how to understand the inner workings of your own mind. Take advantage of that truth that only God makes available to you. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Richard Palmer, Jeremiah Jacques, and Jorg Mardian. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from G.K. Chesterton. There's no such thing on earth as an uninteresting subject. The only thing that can exist is an uninterested person. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.